This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Remember, that's where Bradley Manning's being court-martialed. The trial's taking place, also the headquarters of the National Security Agency. Kevin, the prosecution wrapped up their case last week, and now it's the defense's turn. What is most significant for us to know in the trial at this point?
What I think people should pay attention to is this push to get charges dismissed, which you mentioned at the beginning of this segment here. The aiding the enemy charge is the most severe charge that he faces. And I think that people should really pay attention to how they're charging it, because they're dangerously conflating the act that WikiLeaks engaged in of publishing, which is a First Amendment act, with treason, with espionage against the United States. And they have, the prosecutors, through their arguments, suggested that Manning was working on behalf of WikiLeaks, going into the secret government networks and harvesting information. And so they don't believe that Manning was doing what he did as part of himself wanting to change the world and spark reform. I think that people should really consider that, you know, we know that if you shout fire in a crowded theater, that is generally frowned upon. Well, the prosecutors in this case should not be able to shout terrorism in a military courtroom when there is no evidence at all that Manning's act had any connection whatsoever to terrorism.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 5:01. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Take six.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura and A Different Nature present the film Theremin, An Electronic Odyssey, for this month's KBOO Night at the Clinton Street Theater. The documentary tells the story of Leon Theremin, his invention of the only instrument you play without touching it, and its use in Hollywood films and rock music. The film will be showing 7 p.m. Thursday night, July 11th, at the Clinton Street Theater, corner of Southeast 26th and Clinton, and all proceeds will benefit
KBOO Portland.
On Friday, July 19th, from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m., tune in for KBOO's one-day flash drive fundraiser, a day filled with news and music from the equator to Antarctica.
Lecture topics will include climate change, gay rights, and an overview of African land grabs. Don't miss out on the chance to explore underrepresented music and news from across the Southern Hemisphere on July 19th, from 8 a.m. to 10 p.m.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Friends of KBOO, supporting locally produced, organically grown, homemade programming for Portland and the world. Thanks KBOO for 45 years of music, current affairs, and live broadcasts. Friends of KBOO can be reached at 503-788-2533.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protests and local debate intensified over the proposal to ship coal down the Columbia River Gorge.
The Boston Marathon bomber pleaded not guilty in federal court.
And a bipartisan coalition prevented a vote on lowering student loan interest rates to previous levels.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 10th, 2013. I'm Jennifer Kemp.
And I'm Nia Lewis. A local debate has flared up over Amber Energy Corporation's proposal to ship millions of tons of coal down the Columbia River Gorge. The Oregon Department of Environmental Quality held a hearing yesterday at the Oregon Convention Center and faced a flash mob and protests by activists opposed to coal exports in Oregon. We go to KBOO reporter Josie Lichten for more.
Portland citizens met with Department of Environmental Quality officials at the Oregon Convention Center yesterday for a marathon 12-hour public hearing. The hearing addressed air and water quality permits that the DEQ is considering for Amber Energy Corporation. The coal and oil business would use the permits to ship millions of tons of coal from Montana to an Oregon coastal shipping facility. The coal would travel down the Columbia River Gorge before being shipped to East Asia. Both supporters and opponents of Amber spoke, but outside, the atmosphere was very different. A large crowd gathered in front of the center, holding signs and chanting to protest the permits and the proposal. Many oppose coal fuel in general. Samantha Lockhart is the conservation organizer for Friends of the Columbia Gorge. She worries that citizens cannot trust in Amber's promise of clean and safe shipping techniques.
We have no way of really holding this company accountable to what these claims that they're making. And Amber Energy has a history of lying to communities. Just a couple of years ago in Longview, Washington, they lied about the scale of the proposed export terminal they wanted to build there. So it's definitely a company that we're really nervous about interacting with. And they're working with a somewhat untested technology with these covered barges.
Jim Chase, a Portland resident and avid hiker, fears that the ungainly appearance and noise that barges and trains create will hurt the gorge economy.
This proposal, if all of these things go through, it'll be a net negative job creator. There will be a few jobs created in the terminals, the trains. There will be some temporary construction jobs. But the effect on small businesses, hotels, coffee shops, restaurants, agriculture in the gorge will be devastating. My opinion is 25 full trains a day of coal through the gorge plus some barges. It'll be a death sentence on one of the most beautiful places on earth.
Pollution is also a major concern for the protesters that descended on the hearing yesterday. Citizens have noticed that no matter how safely the coal is transported, it will still end up causing enormous air pollution when it is burned. Lockhart sees no way around this problem.
Regardless of how this is transported, it's still going to mean diesel pollution, it's still going to mean increased traffic, and it's still going to mean burning coal and accelerating climate change, no matter how it's transported. So I don't see a good way of them issuing this permit. I think we're asking the Oregon DEQ to look out for Oregonians and the communities in the gorge and our health and safety and deny the permits.
For KBOO News, this is Josie Lichten in Portland, Oregon.
Oregon conservation organizations have called on Senator Ron Wyden to take action in Congress to protect national forests in Oregon from clear-cut logging. The group says Wyden has been indulging the timber industry with more clear-cuts on public lands, undercutting Oregon tourism and recreation on these lands. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Chandra Legui of Oregon Wild about their new campaign.
I wonder if you could tell us about the new clear cuts in an area near Roseburg, Oregon, that are somehow euphemistically being called variable retention harvests.
There are a couple of timber sales in the Roseburg BLM. One's called Buck Rising, which was logged earlier this spring, and one's called White Castle, which has not yet been logged, but will use the same methods. Being called variable retention harvest, I've visited a few times now and with a number of different people who all take a look at this on the ground and call it a clear cut. There are scattered trees left behind, and there are some groups of trees left in the area, so it's not, hundreds of acres without any trees on it like you see on private land in some areas. But the impacts on the ground on these public lands, it really look a lot like a clear cut. There's very few trees left. It's down to bare earth in some areas. It's, hot and dry. There's very little wildlife habitat left over. And we're very concerned about the impacts of this.
What is a variable retention harvest? What does that actually mean?
A clear cut is generally defined as an area where almost all the trees are removed. And a clear cut with reserves is defined as an area where there's some reserve areas left in a clear cut. building off that definition. And that's what this looks like. The scientists who are promoting the, quote, variable retention harvest define it as leaving some structure in the area to be logged, including up 20 to 30% of the trees behind, some in groups of trees and some scattered across the landscape. There are other ways of doing logging that are far less damaging, especially when we're talking about critical habitat for threatened species.
What about the idea of forest management? I mean, are these regrowth forests or are they natural growth forests that wouldn't necessarily require management?
That's an excellent question. And what we're seeing on these BLM lands is a mixture. The Buck Rising timber sale you asked about was a young stand of trees that was clear-cut in the past and replanted. It was about 50 years old. And, you know, those are more appropriate forest areas to do some logging in to introduce diversity back into since they were managed in the past. However, the White Castle timber sale is a 100 to 120-year-old forest that's never been logged before and is functioning very well as wildlife habitat right now and doesn't need logging to increase diversity or, you know, improve wildlife habitat. And so places like that we think are inappropriate to do this any sort of forest management. You know, I think it's important that Oregonians, like I said, make their voice heard and speak up for the values that they see on their public lands, whether it's clean drinking water, storing carbon to mitigate global warming impacts, or because they're places that they like to hike and fish and camp. So it's important that we all are in this together.
Well, thanks very much, Chandra Legui with Oregon Wild. Again, their website, oregonwild.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A train carrying hazardous material derailed early this morning on Union Pacific tracks east of La Grande, Oregon. State officials recommended evacuations of a nearby RV park and resort, as well as residents within 1 mile of the site of the crash. State police have reported no significant leak of materials. Two tanks in the train were carrying a chemical mixture that included sodium hydroxide or industrial lye. The train was also transporting new automobiles, meat, and the chemical compound glycol. The tanks carrying glycol were not damaged. 8 miles of Highway 203 have been closed for an investigation. The derailment comes just 4 days after a runaway train carrying oil exploded in Quebec, killing 15. The causes of both incidents remain unknown.
World Law Debt has been banned from doing business in Oregon because of aggressive debt collection tactics. World Law Debt is a debt settlement company that works out payment arrangements with creditors. Oregon's Department of Justice's online database has over 700 complaints referring to debt collectors' aggressive strategies used in business. As a result, the debt collecting company, World Law Debt, has been banned from doing business in Oregon with claims that they violate Oregon's Unlawful Trade Practices Act. The Texas company has charged excessive fees and financially abused seniors. As a result of the complaints, Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum and her office have been cracking down aggressively on the forceful debt collectors. The company has been fined $70,000 previously and has not yet paid the fines. Despite the numerous complaints and actions against the company, World Law Debt continues to operate in Oregon and in the state seeks $10 million in civil penalties.
A last-minute addition to the Oregon budget this week doubled the funding for the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund to $4 million per year for the next 2 years. This is not exactly a windfall for the groups that provide emergency shelter and services to people fleeing domestic violence, but it is twice as much money as they received from the state last year. In association with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Casey Decker has more.
At the very end of a long legislative session, Oregon lawmakers acknowledged the growing problems of domestic violence and sexual abuse in the state. They allocated twice as much funding as in the previous 2 years for prevention and services for survivors. It's part of a larger public safety reform effort to shift state dollars away from expanding prisons and into community services that work to prevent crime and help victims. Representative Jen Williamson of Portland says $4 million a year will now be spent on new shelter beds and related services.
When women leave an abusive situation, it is such a tenuous and scary time that if we can get them and their children into a safe place, I think we'll be keeping people from being homeless. I actually think we'll be saving lives.
Williamson says the money will be distributed as soon as possible. The funding was part of what's often called the Christmas tree bill, a budget bill at the end of the session, where general fund dollars not otherwise spoken for are divvied up for a variety of priorities. Previously, domestic and sexual violence prevention efforts had only been funded at about 13% of what the shelter organization said they would need just to meet the current emergency shelter requests in the state. So doubling the funding still leaves a shortfall. However, Representative Greg Matthews of Portland says it's a start.
And I think what we'll start seeing is a change in the trends, and we will be able to start diverting more dollars into community programs. It's not as big or as grandiose as anybody thought it might be, but in the end, it will have a big impact, and I think it'll be for the positive.
He says shelter operators were willing to be part of the give and take on public safety reforms, which got heated at times in this year's legislature. And he's convinced they'll use the money effectively. For KBOO News in association with the Oregon News Service, I'm Casey Decker.
The Portland Police Bureau's Gun Task Force is trying to secure a 5-year contract with a Virginia-based technology group to give them the ability to pull DNA from weapons used in crimes. The Portland Police collect blood or saliva samples from crime scenes, but with the proposed partnership, worth about $350,000 with Bode Technology Group Incorporated, the Bureau will be able to determine who held and fired weapons. Sergeant Kathy Kent, supervisor of the Gun Task Force, said the technology is necessary because officers have a difficult time proving whom a gun belongs to. Kent said that they cannot make many cases for felons in possession of firearms and, quote, "we need to get these guns off the street and out of the hands, in particular, of felons," unquote. Fingerprints are often inconclusive because of the textured surface on guns. Bode Technology Lab claims that it can obtain a DNA sample from as few as 5 to 20 skin cells. If the City Council approves the contract, as it is expected to, the Portland Police Bureau will send samples to Virginia for analysis. Kent said she would send 5 guns a month to the lab. The Bureau would send samples after they identify a suspect and want to confirm whether the DNA from the firearm matches the suspect's. While this technology is able to pull DNA from smaller biological material, it sometimes can only show a partial profile of a single person or DNA profiles from several people.
As of today, inmates in the Pelican Bay Maximum Security Prison enter their second day of a hunger strike protesting the horrific conditions and treatment received by prisoners in indefinite solitary confinement. The strike began in 2011 in the Pelican Bay Maximum Security Prison and have resumed intermittently during times of shaky negotiation. The latest strike began on Monday. This strike started in reaction to solitary confinement conditions, cutting inmates off from human contact and sunlight for 24 hours a day. "There's a core group of us committed to taking this to the death if necessary," says Todd Ashker, an inmate of Pelican Bay State Prison in Crescent City. Family members and supporters of the strike have formed a coalition to help further the reform of punishment tactics used on prisoners and the end of indefinite solitary confinement. This type of confinement has been described by some as state-sanctioned torture. Representatives of the critical resistance group met with attorneys at Pelican Bay. The Department of Corrections and Rehabilitations does not recognize a hunger strike until the inmates have missed 9 meals in a row. As of Tuesday afternoon, the inmates have missed 5.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News after this newscast, followed by Right to Survive at 6, Confronting the Housing Crisis and Systemic Inequalities. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is mostly cloudy with a high temperature near 75 degrees.
This is no ordinary girl.
It's 5:19 in the post-meridian. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In 2007, a Texas school superintendent rejected any need for sex education classes. Noting that many students in his district live on farms, he said, they get a pretty good sex education from their animals. Guess which state is number one in teen pregnancies? Yes, Texas. And who should be the ones to make medical decisions about pregnancies? Not women, their doctors, or their ministers. Rather, the macho Republican autocrats and theocrats who control Texas state government say they are the ones to decide such deeply personal matters. How embarrassing for these political bullies, then, to have had their repressive, extremist, and dangerous anti-choice legislation derailed by, well, by women. Some 2,000 of them recently flooded into the Capitol building to support Senator Wendy Davis, who mounted an 11-hour filibuster against the GOP scheme, and this crowd of women shouted down the leaders when they tried to rig the rules to silence Davis and ram their bill into law. The women's outcry startled Governor Rick Oops Perry, who later whimpered that the people's assertion of citizens' authority was a hijacking of the democratic process. Odd concept, the people hijacking democracy. Odder yet is that these same Republicans once tried to hijack Senator Davis's district by gerrymandering most of her minority voters into another district. And now Perry is trying to hijack reality, huffing and puffing that he'll slap down the women's opposition to his assault on their rights because, quote, that's what the people of this state hired us to do. This is Jim Hightower saying, get a grip, Rick. In a June poll, 74% of Texas voters, including 6 out of 10 Republicans, say such personal decisions should be made by women and their doctors, not by political quacks masquerading as Talibanic moral autocrats.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
One of the two suspects in the bombing of the Boston Marathon, Jizohar Tsarnaev, has pleaded not guilty today to 30 counts of violent crime associated with the attack. The April attack killed 3 people and wounded more than 250, and the subsequent police chase led to the death of an MIT police officer and Tsarnaev's brother and fellow bomber, Tamerlan. The prosecution is likely to seek the death penalty. The defense will attempt to argue that 19-year-old Jizohar acted only under the influence of his older brother, Tamerlan. However, a message scribbled by Jizohar while hiding from police explaining the motive for the attacks will likely be used by the prosecution to prove Jizohar had an independent thought process. The message says in part, quote, the U.S. government is killing our innocent civilians. I can't stand to see such evil unpunished. We Muslims are one body. You hurt one, you hurt all of us.
U.S. District Judge Denise Cote ruled today that Apple conspired with major publishers to raise the retail price of e-books. The ruling is a result of a 2012 lawsuit filed by the U.S. Department of Justice against Apple and 5 major publishers for artificially manipulating the e-book market. Before Apple entered the market in 2010, Amazon was the dominant e-book provider, and many publishers complained about the low retail price of books on the site. But when Apple released iBooks in 2010, it introduced a new style of e-book sales called agency pricing, where the publisher, rather than the retailer, sets the price, with Apple taking a cut of each sale. Subsequently, publishers raised the price of ebooks in the Apple Store and forced Amazon to do the same. The DOJ filed suit against Apple along with publishers Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin, and Simon & Schuster. All 5 publishers settled, and under the terms of the settlement, may no longer restrict a retailer's ability to lower the price of books. Apple, however, did not settle and went to trial. Even after the ruling, Apple denies wrongdoing and says they will appeal the decision. Assistant Attorney General Bill Baer said in a press release today that the result is, quote, a victory for millions of consumers who choose to read books electronically.
A new report released by a British human rights organization has documented violent tactics used against Guantanamo Bay hunger strikers, which they say are an attempt by authorities to break the will of the hunger strikers. 106 prisoners began participating in the hunger strike in February to protest their delayed release and poor conditions. Currently, 45 of the hunger strikers are being force-fed by the U.S. military personnel. The report details heavy-handed procedures meant to break the strike, using testimony from the strikers themselves. The techniques include force-feeding, forcible cell extraction, and the solitary confinement of striking individuals. The human rights group, which issued the report, said that the prisoners believe that these measures are meant to prevent them achieving solidarity. President Obama continues to receive pressure from human rights advocates to carry out his promise to close Guantanamo and to stop the force feeding of hunger strikers. Force feeding has been condemned by the UN and World Medical Association as a form of torture. In the Guantanamo hunger strike, most of the prisoners involved have lost a third of their weight and suffered from a variety of health problems, including chest pain, low blood pressure, and problems with their sight.
A new report released today by Public Citizen lays out a roadmap for states to provide universal health care at a state level. The roadmap explains how states can use aspects of the Affordable Care Act to move toward a single-payer health care system. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Dave Stierit, one of the authors of the report.
I wonder if you can tell us about your new roadmap for states to implement single-payer health care plans at the state level.
Absolutely. With the Affordable Care Act providing flexibility for states to design their health care delivery system, we wanted to identify the challenges for states and provide them a way to overcome those challenges.
And what are the main points of the roadmap?
The main points are, one, that you can really move forward towards a single-payer system as a state. And we tell you what legislation you need to pass, what federal challenges you will have, and we provide solutions for those problems without giving suggestions, but we provide the information.
What impact would single-payer have on employer-related health plans?
Well, the wonderful thing about single payer is that it would take the health insurance burden away from employers, like pretty much every other industrialized country. So our employers, large and small, throughout the United States, would be able to compete on a level playing field with the rest of the world and increase productivity and increase employment. Also, when you move to a single payer system, you get a system that costs a lot less than we're currently spending, and it also provides better healthcare outcomes for patients.
Do you think that there has been misinformation put out about what single payer is? I know the Affordable Care Act had the death panel misnomer attached to it, even though there was nothing like that in the bill. Are there similar misnomers that have been put out about single payer healthcare that are untrue?
Definitely. I think many of them are along the same lines. There's a lot of misinformation put out there about the whole concept of rationing, kind of like the death panel misinformation. People say, well, you're going to take away your health care or take away your grandparents' health care. And that's just not the case that we've seen in other countries that cover single-payer care.
What would you suggest for a state like Oregon that's now engaging in this study of single-payer and other options as next steps to move forward toward the single-payer system that you are promoting?
Well, I think, you know, they should definitely take a look at the report. I think they should really talk to the healthcare experts, the brightest minds on this topic. You know, there's a group called Physicians for National Health Program, which have been working on this along with Public Citizen for decades. They've got a multitude of great information on this, which can really help lawmakers understand that they're making a smart decision to move in this direction. They should hold hearings, you know, hold legislative hearings on this. And then once they're comfortable, you can move slowly. That's what Vermont's doing. They passed a bill making it possible, and then they work towards it. You don't change, you know, a multi-billion-dollar healthcare economy overnight, but, you know, do your due diligence, and you'll get it right, and I think you'll be pleasantly surprised.
Again, I've been speaking with Dave Stierit with Public Citizen, their new report that provides states with a roadmap of how to achieve unified universal health coverage is available on their website, citizen.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Legislative efforts to bring subsidized student loan interest rates back down to their previous 3.4% rate for the next year have been impeded by a bipartisan coalition. Democrat Joe Manchin III of West Virginia, Independent Angus King of Maine, and Republican Richard M. Burr of North Carolina opted against a Democratic bill and instead drafted a plan that they call a compromise between Republican and Democratic interests. The compromise promised to neither make money for the government nor cost it and would guarantee a fixed interest rate for the duration of loans. Despite being touted as a compromise, Democrats refused to vote on the bipartisan plan. Manchin and King broke party lines and, along with Republicans, voted to filibuster the original Democratic bill. As of today, no bills have been passed. Student loans for next school year will be distributed at the beginning of August. Unless a bill is passed in the next several weeks, interest rates will remain at 6.8% as a result of legislative gridlock.
The Texas State House of Representatives today passed a bill that would severely restrict abortion statewide. The bill now moves to the Senate, which also has a wide Republican majority. House Bill 2 passed 98-49, mostly along party lines, in the special legislative session called for by Governor Rick Perry. The extended session was necessary due to the last-minute filibuster of the bill in the regular session by State Senator Wendy Davis, who talked for 10 hours straight to prevent the measure from coming to a vote. Though the conservative majority ruled her filibuster over due to various procedural violations, the public crowd in the Senate grew so loud that votes could not be heard and the bill did not pass before the deadline. The bill would prohibit abortions after 20 weeks and restrict which doctors and clinics may provide the procedure. Proponents argue that legislation will make abortions safer, and many have moral objections to the practice at all. Opponents say the bill would eliminate all but 5 abortion clinics in the state, increasing the likelihood that women living in rural areas will seek abortions in dangerous underground clinics. The bill still needs to make it out of Senate committee, be passed by the Senate, and be signed by the governor. But with a conservative-controlled Senate, a conservative governor, and plenty of time, passage is expected.
The Tribune Company announced on Wednesday that it would split its newspaper and broadcasting properties into 2 separate divisions. The print media will form the Tribune Publishing Company, and the broadcasting properties will remain with the other company assets in the Tribune Company. The company owner says this is an attempt to separate the high-value, high-return entertainment and television assets from print media, which has lost revenue in recent years. Representatives from the Tribune Company say that they are considering selling off some or all of their newspaper assets. This follows a similar move last week by media mogul Rupert Murdoch, who split his multi-billion-dollar News Corp into 2 branches.
The Large Retailer Accountability Act in the District of Columbia will come to a critical vote on Friday. The act would require retailers with yearly revenues of $1 billion or more to pay all employees in their D.C. outlets a living wage of no less than $12.50 an hour, in contrast to the minimum wage of $8.25 in the district. Retail giant Walmart, who would be required to pay the living wages under the act, says it will pull out its D.C. stores if the bill passes. Walmart, which is currently constructing 3 Washington stores and has plans for another 3, says if the LRAA passes, it won't begin construction on the planned stores and might even stop the construction on the 3 stores already underway. A Walmart regional general manager called the act, quote, legislation that discriminates against business in an op-ed piece on Tuesday. The living wage of $12.50 an hour translates to $26,000 a year for a 40-hour work week with no leave, only slightly above the federal poverty line of $23,050 for a 4-person family.
The National Security Agency has been conducting extensive spying on South American countries, confirmed by NSA document recently exposed by whistleblower Edward Snowden. The major focuses of NSA surveillance in South America are Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia, according to a feature story in Brazilian newspaper Jornal O Globo, written by Guardian reporter Glenn Greenwald, among others. The NSA is also tracking phone calls and emails from Venezuela, Nicaragua, Argentina, Ecuador, Panama, Costa Rica, Honduras, Paraguay, Chile, Peru, and El Salvador. The NSA has been using surveillance technologies known as PRISM and Boundless Informant, which have been used to spy in European countries and in the United States. Their target is not only South American military secrets, but also trade information that can be gleaned from phone calls and emails. In Venezuela, the NSA is fishing for information about oil, and in Mexico, their primary aim is information about energy. Edward Snowden remains in the Moscow airport, but has been seeking political asylum from a number of South American countries. Most recently, he has appealed to consistently left-leaning Venezuela. Nicolas Maduro, who has served as the Venezuelan president since President Hugo Chavez passed away earlier this year, says he will welcome Snowden coming to his country.
Russia's ambassador to the United States has claimed that a team of Russian experts found significant evidence that chemical weapons have been used by opposition forces in Syria. This runs counter to claims by the U.S. and EU that the Syrian government used chemical weapons against the opposition. The violence in Syria began during the Arab Spring of 2011, and in the 2 years of war since, almost 100,000 people have died. Both the rebel fighters and the Syrian military under President Bashar al-Assad have accused each other of using chemical weapons, specifically the neurotoxin sarin. Both sides deny the accusations by the other. The United States and many other countries believe the Syrian government is the only group to use such weapons, while Russia, Syria's closest ally, argues that only the rebels have used chemical weapons. Both sides claim high confidence in their analysis and low confidence in their opponent's analysis. But no conclusive evidence has been publicly released showing chemical weapon usage by either side in the Syrian conflict.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, Afghan police killed 24 Taliban militants across the country today, according to the Afghan Interior Ministry. 9 militants were injured and 8 were wounded. 2 civilians were killed and 3 were injured in a roadside bomb attack in southern Helmand province today.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center. www.imemc.org for Wednesday, July the 10th, 2013. Israel is planning a new illegal settlement activity. In the meantime, settlers' assault in Hebron continue, and the Gaza flotilla planning to leave the Gaza Strip despite the blockade. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Canadian European and Palestinian activists are planning to launch a flotilla from Gaza that would carry local produce and textiles to Europe in defiance of the Israeli-imposed naval blockade. The flotilla, called Gaza's Ark, will consist of converted fishing vessel. Israel instituted the blockade of Gaza Strip in 2006. This has severely harmed Gaza's economy, increasing poverty and unemployment, and has had a devastating impact on the healthcare system. Israel announced the illegal construction of 500 units for the settlers in the West Bank, a move that has been strongly denounced by Dr. Hana Issa, an expert in international law. Dr. Issa says that this new settlement activity is another Israeli violation of international law and an attempt to foil direct peace talks. He added that continued settlement activity in occupied Palestine violates Israel's various international obligations, such as the Roadmap Peace Plan, the Geneva Convention, and the Geneva Protocols. Also, in 2004, the International Court of Justice ruled that Israel's settlement activity in the West Bank is illegal. Dr. Issa described how the illegal settlements deprive Palestinians of opportunities and how they jeopardize the establishment of a viable and independent Palestinian state. Furthermore, Israel's illegal settlement activity and its actions concerning Palestinian resources and human rights violate all related United Nations resolutions. In Ar-Rahim Valley, southern West Bank, a number of bulldozers belonging to Israeli settlers approached the land belonging to a local Al-Halis family. Local sources say that the bulldozers ravaged the land by digging up large amounts of sand to transport it to nearby illegal settlement of Susia. In other news, a Palestinian medical source in El Janid neighborhood north of Nablus reported that 5 people were injured and 1 kidnapped during a nighttime invasion by Israeli soldiers. The soldiers fired rubber-coated bullets, tear gas and concussion grenades into the dormitories of Al-Najah National University in the city, injuring 5 students. The soldiers kidnapped student Mahmoud At-Talama before they exited the building. Reports said that the Israeli soldiers also fired gas bombs at a female dormitory belonging to the local college of the neighboring Rafidia area. The bomb caused a fire, with 1 student receiving treatment for smoke inhalation. The military vehicles drove around An-Najah University in Rafidia and the neighborhood before leaving. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was Wednesday, July the 10th, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Shama Slane White and me, Ida Van Heine.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Vince Giramonte, Kelsang Nima, myself, Jennifer Kemp, Robin Ryan, Casey Decker, and Josie Lichten. The producer is Ben Renner. Special thanks to the reporters at the Oregon News Service. Our engineer is Kurt Lauer. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jennifer Kemp.
And I'm Nia Lewis.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty reviews the recent Oregon legislative session with Oregon State Senator Jackie Dingfielder. At 9 on Press Watch, host Teresa Mitchell says capitalism, it's not a victimless crime, and presents more news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on A Deeper Look, host Linda Olson Osterlin interviews FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley about NSA spying and the harm done to democracy and to the media trying to report about it. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Between the Covers, host David Naiman interviews Matt Bell about his new novel, In the House Upon the Dirt Between the Lake and the Woods. It's so unique that people are struggling to describe just what it is. And at 11:30, SW Concert hosts Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comics artists. Thanks, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not a financial supporter, why not become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Have a lovely evening.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 10th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Police arrested a group of caregivers and patients fighting to prevent the closure of a more than 150-year-old Brooklyn hospital today. FSRN's Peter Rue was there.
Doctors, nurses, and patients from Long Island College Hospital refused a police order to disperse from their post outside the State University of New York's Chancellor's Office. SUNY's Board of Trustees voted to close the deficit-burdened hospital last winter, but has been impeded from doing so by a restraining order from the New York Supreme Court. The court ruled the closure would create a public health crisis in the area. However, last month, the school began diverting resources